comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Welcome to talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. That's a guarantee. I'm here because it matters, and so do you. Don't forget, if you have not yet subscribed to the K-Files eZine, be sure you do subscribe to the K-Files eZine. It's our free weekly newsletter. And it goes out each week, usually. Didn't go out last week, and I explained last night why. But it goes out each week, free of charge, and it always has good information. You have inside information from the show. And then you have articles from around the world that are about things that we talk about here on the show. Links and the links that take you to other articles, and then video links that take you to interesting videos related to things we talk about here on the show. So it's absolutely free, no strings attached, none whatsoever. You can unsubscribe anytime you decide to do so. So go over to my website, which is kevinsmithshow.com, and subscribe. Just click where it says K-Files eZine and subscribe. It takes a few seconds. Big news today. There was a huge earthquake out in the South Pacific. Now, they were saying it was 7.9. They have upgraded that estimate now to 8.3 on the Richter scale. Just before showtime, the news that I had, the update that I had, said that a tsunami did hit both Samoa and American Samoa. And the report that I read said there were deaths in American Samoa. We don't know about, at this point, I don't know about anything else. I don't know how many deaths. I don't know about deaths anywhere else. Hawaii is on a tsunami alert, as is New Zealand. So if you folks in Hawaii are listening, and you folks in New Zealand, and I know you are because we get email from both places, move to higher ground. Get away from the coast. This may dissipate. There may be no tsunami hitting Hawaii. There may be no tsunami hitting New Zealand. But don't take the chance, and don't stand on the beach and shake your fist at it and say that you're not going to be run off of your land, because you will. It will win. So move to higher ground. Get away from the coastline. You know, a few months ago on this show, my guest was Jerry Wills, and Jerry Wills was talking about some discoveries he had made down in South America. When we opened the phone line, a caller called in, and Jerry recognized who it was. And he said, this guy has some really important information, some good information. He's done a lot of research with the ancient sites down there, and he's got good information. That's my guest tonight. His name is Matt Martirano, and he will join us right after this. Thank you. My guest, Matt Martirano, is a doctor of naturopathic medicine. He is also a researcher into ancient sites. Not just ancient sites, but ancient sites and their mysteries. And that includes discovering some pretty amazing things about their relationship to stars and star systems. As I said, he called in to talk with us when we had Jerry Wills on a few months ago. Jerry said this guy's got good information, and I have to tell you, the information that he sent me today is basically a summary. This is just a summary of his work, and I have read it all. It is a 62-page summary, and it is absolutely dynamite. Matt, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Hi, Kevin. Well, thanks for having me, and thanks to your listeners for tuning in.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about, the things we're going to look at here tonight are in South America. Now, you're a doctor of naturopathic medicine. You're located in the north in the United States. And how did you wind up in South America taking a look at these ancient sites and making these discoveries?
Well, the story of how I got down there, and of course with what I came up with, kind of happened by chance. I was living in Colorado at the time with a good friend of mine, Annie DeRiso, and who knows Jerry Wills. And what had happened, it was about the end of 2006, and I had just got a call from my dad who said that he had some miles that were expiring for a ticket, and that if I wanted to go anywhere in the 48 states, I had a free ticket. Well, I had always been interested in going down to South America, particularly to Peru, and the first question that popped out of my mouth was, well, how much would it be to upgrade to a ticket to Peru? So we looked into it, and it was a couple $100, and I got on the phone. Annie connected me with Jerry, who would happen to be heading down there about the same time, and basically headed down there on a whim, had a cell phone number for Jerry in Lima, and got on a plane, and a couple weeks later I was down in Peru.
All right, now, when you went down there, you didn't go down there specifically with the mindset of being an explorer, right? I mean, you just sort of went down there just to see what's what, right?
Right, yeah, not at all. And in fact, I had really no plans at all, and I was kind of excited about that, actually. I had no itinerary, just had a ticket, and sort of showed up, and Jerry and Kathy were very graceful and showing me around, and my trip just sort of happened.
All right, now, you've made some pretty astounding discoveries as a result of that trip. So, take us to that. Tell us what's the beginning of it, and what is it that resulted from it?
Sure. Well, I had I'd gotten down to Peru, and at the time I met up with Jerry and Kathy and their son Bryce, who's a musician, happened to be having a concert that night. And they invited me to go down, and I accepted, and we showed up at this concert, and essentially what had happened is I met up with his producer there, who owned a lodge, the Amazon Rainforest Lodge in Iquitos, Peru, and that was one of the places I wanted to visit, and so he invited me to come down there, so I went over there for a while. I met up with a shaman in the area. We had done a few ceremonies, and then I had wanted to head off to Cusco. So about maybe 8-9 days into the trip, I showed up in Cusco, and of course my main intention at the time, as with most first visitors to that area, was to go visit Machu Picchu. And so I was just basically making my way to Machu Picchu. I was heading up north in the valley, and I planned to stay at a place in Pisac, which is a little town just about an hour and a half or so by bus out of Cusco. And there was a little place there called Posse Luz I wanted to stay at, and I arrived there, and I was really exhausted from my trip. It was a long day, of course, of traveling and what have you, and I showed up there and got to my room, and then I was really exhausted, flopped down on the bed, and I went to take a little nap. Well, as I was napping, I had what I would consider to be an experience. You could call it a dream, but the more the things that came from that dream lead me to believe it was more than that. Essentially, in the dream, I encountered two women, and we were in a scene. We were walking around a building, and in this building, it was sort of it was two floors. We were walking around the top floor. I could hear voices coming from the bottom floor. And there was sort of an, I guess, sort of an atrium or an opening to the second floor. And we were just talking. And one of the women who identified herself, she said her name was Floor. The other one didn't talk much. She had been talking to me, and she said she was relating to me a story of when she had been working in Lima at a financial institution. And outside of there, there was a homeless man, she was telling me, who would kind of, he hung out underneath the steps. And, you know, she'd see him day after day when she'd come in. And one day she was on her way in, and she was in quite a rush driving down the street in order to get to work. And this man happened to step out in front of her vehicle, and she hit him, and he died. And so she's telling me this story. Now, mind you, the whole time I'm thinking in my mind, and, you know, so what? Well, you know, why are you telling this story? Okay, so this happened. Feel sad for the guy, but, you know, I'm curious as to know why. And she sort of stopped, and she looked at me, and she said, well, this man was you. And I sort of paused, and I was like, well, that's very strange. And immediately asked her, well, when did this happen? And she said, in 1998. And so, of course, I thought to myself and expressed to her, well, in 1998, I was back in the States. I was in college at the time. And, you know, this doesn't make any sense to me. I don't get it. And what she had explained to me was that this man was essentially another part of myself, or that I guess the best way to explain it was that we shared a group soul, and that when she had hit this man, it sort of created an energetic void, which eventually resulted in me heading down there to Peru. And so I thought that was very interesting. We talked a bit more
about and this is all in a dream, though, right?
Right, right. This is. I'm passed out in the bed at the time in Peacock. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so the scene shifted after that, and we were in this little park sitting on a bench, and there was a statue next to us. And we were talking a bit more, and then she said, you know, it's going to be, we're going to take our leave from you here in a few minutes, and is there anything that you want to ask us? And then, you know, the whole time I'm thinking in my mind, is there any way that I can verify, you know, what these women are telling me, you know, here in this dream? I mean, is there anything that will, that I can, you know, in real life, that's gonna make a connection? And so I said, yeah. I said, you know, that building that we are walking around, I said, what do you call that place? And she looked at me and she said, well, what we call it is Nuevo Cordones. And I said, which translates into English as New Quarters. And, of course, kind of being a smart aleck, actually, at the time, I looked at her and I said, well, what was the old quarters, you know? And she looked at her friend, and they looked back at me, and they both kind of smiled, and they said, no, that's just what we call the place, New Quarters. Okay. So I woke up. I continued on my trip to Machu Picchu, had a wonderful experience there. I was back in Cusco about a week later, and at the time, I... had sort of just got a wild hair up my butt that I wanted to go back and visit this temple that was up above the city, the Temple of the Moon. It's called Salapunco. And it was the full moon. I wanted to head up there, and I'd been up there before, and the entrance had been closed because a tourist had actually fallen down through a crevice earlier that year, and they had an accident. I sort of had this wild harebrained idea to go up there in the middle of the night and liberate the place. So anyhow, I was on the internet, and I was looking for maps because I knew I needed to get back to this place. I wasn't exactly sure how to get there. And I was searching for maps of Cusco. I pulled up a map on the internet that was centered around the Plaza de Armas, which is the sort of center of Cusco. And my eye was drawn to the very left edge of the map where there was two roads that conjoined. And so this was the same road to sort of change name after you pass over an intersection. And one of the names was Calle Nuevo, and the other one was Siete Cortones. So putting them together, you get Nuevo Cortones, or New Quarters. I said, wow, this is absolutely incredible. I'll head out there on my way up to the temple, and I'll see what I find. So I headed out there, and on the corner I found a building. It's a two-story building, and walking back and forth around the corner, and on one of the corners I noticed that there was this cube of rock. It's a very interesting type of rock that you find. I had only come across it at some of the sacred sites. And on the other side of the building, along the bottom row in the foundation, there is a set of symbols that's engraved in the building. And so I'm sort of trying
now,
to...
Is this an ancient building, or is this a modern building?
Well, it has an ancient foundation. As with many buildings in Cusco, the foundations are incredibly old, but on top of it was just built a normal building, which I found out from a lady selling snacks on the street is now a high school.
Okay.
So it's a high school now, and sort of peeking my head in the windows, and I could see from the inside of the building that this was, in fact, the same building that I remembered from my dream. So I thought that was pretty interesting, but I wanted to get out to the temple, so I was, you know, planned ahead on my way. I headed down the street, and there's a little church right up the street with a courtyard, and I stopped in there just to rest and check my maps and such, and sat down on a bench, and all of a sudden I was just struck by this incredible sense of deja vu, and I looked around me, and it was the exact same scene from the dream. So that second scene where we had gone and we were sitting on the bench right before the end, that's where I was sitting. Statue, the bench, I remembered very distinctly because it was quite battered, and the statue was sitting right next to me. So, I made a plan to come back there the next day and sort of check things out. And meanwhile, I headed up to the temple, and on my way out there, I encountered these two guards. So they have guards out there at these sacred sites at night because to avoid tourists going up there and mucking around. And so they stopped me on my way, and of course they were said, you know, well, why are you here? What are you looking for? I said, oh, I just want to check something out at the temple. You know, they wanted to look at my bag, see if I had alcohol. I said, no, you know, I don't have. I said, this sweater, and, you know, I had a cana, an Andean flute at the time. So they said, okay. I finally negotiated with them to be able to stay up there for about 20 minutes, and they said, and we're going to shine our flashlights at you, and then it's time to come down. So 20 minutes go by, they're escorting me back towards the city, and as we're taking this little path in towards the city, and at the time as we were walking back, I was asking about the school. Well, I asked one of the guards, you know, do you know anything about this school? You know, this and that. And at the time, I was very interested in learning more about this tunnel system that exists underneath the city. And he goes, yeah, you know, he says to me, I actually went to that school. I said, oh, really? It says, well, you know, can you tell me, is there anything underneath the school? And he said, yeah, actually, you know, underneath there's an underground lake, and there's a passageway that leads to the cathedral in the middle of the city. So as I was walking back through the town, I noticed the pathway that we're going down continued through the city of Cusco, and it happened to sort of line up with this statue that's sort of at this Theo Valle. It's sort of a big turnaround. Cars go around off in different directions in the city, and that's what sort of got me clued into this idea of architectural structures and how they might be positioned in the city in order to indicate what's going on underground. So at the time, that was totally what I was thinking. I hadn't been thinking anything else at all beyond that. But I headed out the next day, and I wanted to grab the best map that I could for the city of Cusco. And so I was going around all these bookstores and eventually found a map that, of course, was very detailed. It had all of the attractions, all the churches and attractions and things in that around the city. And so I got this map, and I was sitting down. I thought, okay, well, I'm going to take a little tour. And I noticed at the time that there was four major churches that are centered around the Plaza de Armas. And as you may know, when the Spaniards came to South America, one of the things that they did was that they built the Christian churches on top of all of these old sacred sites. And one of them, one of the points was on top of what's called Coricancha, or the Temple of the Sun, which was the central location in Cusco during the Inca Empire or before. And all the roads converged on this point. And I noticed that the four of these churches happened to be in the form of a cross, which I just thought was really interesting that they would use some Christian symbology. And at that point in time, I just thought it was a curiosity that the churches were in a cross, and sort of made some notes on my map, and I continued on with my trip. So then what happened is I ended up going back to Peru about a month later. I stayed for some time, and one of the things that kept coming up in conversation and or through various methods was the Southern Cross. So the Southern Cross is a constellation. It's only visible from the Southern Hemisphere. It's akin to what we would use in the Northern Hemisphere in terms of the pole star used to navigate, but it's not quite at the pole, so you have to do a little bit of calculations to try to use that.
Okay, we have to step away for a break. And when we come back from this break, we'll continue talking with Matt Martirano and his discoveries. We'll find out in a moment. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking with Matt Martirano and hearing how he came about the discoveries that he's going to be sharing with us in just a moment. Matt, whenever we stepped away for break, you were talking about the, you had noticed that these four churches actually formed. If you looked at them on a map, they form a cross, and at first you thought, well, that's cool. They laid this out so that it's Christian symbology. But then when you went back to South America, went back to Peru, you kept coming across things that referred to the Southern Cross, right?
That's right. Exactly, Kevin. You know, at the time, I hadn't really given much thought to it, except that this had kept coming up, and it wasn't actually till I had gotten back to the States again, and I was looking at this, and I had downloaded, of course, I got Google Earth. I was still fairly new at the time. I got some astronomy software, and I was looking at these things, and I realized that the two lines that form across, they didn't really make a 90-degree angle at all. In fact, it was quite a number of degrees off center. But having had the idea of the Southern Cross in my mind, I immediately recognized that these four points seem to be in the formation of the Southern Cross. So I got on the net. I downloaded a bunch of star maps focused on the Southern Cross, and I loaded up Google Earth, marked the points on a map, and then I imported the image. You can do an image overlay on Google Earth. And lo and behold, these four churches do in fact line up exactly if you overlay a star map with the four stars of the Southern Cross.
What significance does that have?
Well, you know, at the time, I wasn't sure. I'd certainly had heard before. I'm not new to the study of archaeoastronomy. I was certainly familiar with the idea of various landmarks being aligned with stars, particularly with Giza, the Giza Plateau in Egypt. Had read that work, and I thought, oh, well, you know, I've come across something here. And I looked all over the internet to see if I could find it anywhere else. I didn't find it. And so the next thing I did was I said, okay, well, I wonder what happens if you look out. So let's say I take my astronomy software and I'm looking out from Coricancha, the Temple of the Sun, and there's a path that leads out through the city. It's quite a major street right now. It's leads into a causeway. It's called Avenida del Sol, or Path of the Sun. And the bearing on that is 151.51 degrees. Now, mind you, Coricancha itself, which any of your listeners are into numerology, its latitude is 13 degrees south, 31 minutes, and 13 seconds. So you have 13, 31, 13. Is the location of this temple, and then you have this pathway leading out at 151.51, and the street nearby is called Avenida del Sol, and or Path of the Sun. And I figured from what I had learned that, oh, you know, maybe the sun rises over this pathway, you know, once a year or something like that. So I got on my software and I'm kind of moving backwards and forwards through time, and I'm trying to see when the sun rises over this path. And lo and behold, it doesn't rise over this pathway at all, ever. In fact, the sun never rises that far south. And so I thought, well, maybe that's that. But, you know, maybe there's something more to it. And so I did a little bit more research into the Inca, into their cosmology, and learned that although they call it the Temple of the Sun, and if you kind of look a little bit deeper into the more esoteric traditions, what they really were calling the sun, and according to some interpretations, was the star Sirius, or that they called the second sun. And I immediately recognized that, of course, being important in Egyptian mythology. And I immediately thought of the alignment at the Giza pyramids with what's called the heliacal rising of Sirius during the age of Leo, so about 12,500 years ago. So again, I was focused in the past. I was rewinding in time, and I was looking to see if Sirius, in fact, rises and he makes any sort of significant conjugations with anything in the sky. And I, in fact, did find that around the same time that the Giza Plateau was aligned, you do get a similar alignment there in Coricancha, where the sun is at its southernmost point in the sky, so that would correspond to the winter solstice, and Sirius is rising, and they rise at the same time, and Sirius at that is aligned right there at the 151.51 degrees. So that in and of itself I thought was fascinating. I've been very interested in learning about these connections between Egyptian symbology and architecture, and you know, of course, what we call Inca symbology and architecture. Now, of course, the pink elephant in the corner is that the Egyptians and the Inca were separated not only by an ocean and a mountain range, but by several thousand years in time. So it was very curious to me that you would find these same motifs appearing in these two cultures, separated by both time and space. But I thought it was very interesting in and of itself.
I want to underscore a point here. I think this is important. The fact that they are separated by thousands of miles of ocean and by many hundreds of years is pretty interesting because of the fact that you have that alignment in Egypt thousands of years before you have it. Let me restate it. Apparently, that alignment was marked by the architecture in Egypt thousands of years before it was marked here in South America. When the people in South America did it, they were marking something they apparently had never observed.
That's right, Kevin. And you know, according to what traditional history will teach us, that you know these civilizations had no connection whatsoever. You know, people didn't cross the ocean until much later. But actually, when I was looking into that a little bit further, what I discovered was if you look at the legends of Viracocha, which was considered to be the first Inca god. He appeared, according to legend, somewhere in the region of Lake Titicaca. He was white. He was a white man. He was bearded. He had a sister wife, and he basically brought to the people the idea of civilization. And much of the story of Viracocha actually parallels the story of Akhenaten, who was one of the pharaohs in Egypt. He wasn't a pharaoh for a very long time, but during the time that he was, he made great strides in towards the lines of advancing mathematics and architecture, all of the things that we would call modern civilization. And of course, he was reported to be bearded as well. There's some of the skull features that are unusual that you find. He also, of course, had a sister wife and things like that. So that in and of itself, I thought, was particularly fascinating.
Okay.
So what happened was actually I was living in Colorado at the time. My parents came to visit. I was sort of excited about this discovery and I was showing it to them. And my mom... of all people, who is not a 2012 buff or anything of the sort, just sort of randomly remarks, she says, "I wonder what you would find if you put in 21st December 2012." I said, "Well, that would be interesting." So I plugged in the numbers and popped it up on my astronomy software. I was using Stellarium. And lo and behold, there is an alignment of the Southern Cross. In fact, the center of the Southern Cross rises at that exact same point, the 151.51 degrees on 21 December 2012. And this alignment happens at about 11 p.m. It's actually 11:39:13 is the exact time, which is not too far from the date that you hear in other alignments. What Jerry was talking about that night when we talked about was at 11:11 p.m. you get the alignment at Tiwanaku. And so I was playing with this a little bit, and of course, you know, in the scheme of tens of thousands or even millions of years, you think, well, a few minutes isn't that big of a deal. But I was playing with it, and I was trying to find out, okay, what is the exact moment that this constellation rises? So the first star of the constellation of the Southern Cross that rises over the horizon is called Alpha Crux. And Alpha Crux arises on that particular date at exactly 11 p.m., 18 minutes, and 13 seconds. And so I thought, you know, well, hey, you know, what's a few minutes? Not that big of a deal. Until I found later, so again, this is after the fact, I found, according to Howard Middleton Jones, who actually found a star map to ground correlation at Giza in 2012, at exactly the same time. 22 hours, 18 minutes, 13 seconds. And so as you could see from the map that I sent you in the notes, that is the exact moment on that day that the Southern Cross rises over the horizon as you're looking out from Coricancha.
What do you think the significance of all that is?
Well, you know, the significance, I think, is important, first of all, in that, you know, most people are familiar with the Mayan calendar. Most people have heard about this date by now. You know, if you've tuned in to various shows on the television, you'll hear of all this talk of Armageddon and bad things coming down, the end of the world. And, of course, you know, the debunkers that come along, they're right in the idea that the Mayan civilization or the Incas and none of these people ever actually talked about a cataclysm or the end of the earth. But nevertheless, you look at the calendar, you look at these sites such as Giza and Tiwanaku, Cusco and others, and they're all pointing to the same point in time. I mean, why would they take such great lengths to point to a time in the future that was thousands or even tens of thousands years ahead from where they were? And so it leads you to think, you know, is there anything special that's going on around this time right now? And when you look at it, there actually is. There's an incredible amount of scientific research that's been done looking at this and related ideas. The first place that I would direct anyone who's listening to look is at David Wilcox site, DivineCosmos.com. He's done a wonderful job of actually looking at all this from a scientific basis. But what you see is that there's a few things going on. There's a confluence of three things that are actually happening right now. And the first that I've come across that I think is probably the most pertinent is that if you look in history, there was actually some research done by Professor Mueller at Berkeley Lab in California. And in 2005, what he had discovered was if you look at the fossil records, that there is a distinct periodicity of 62 million years in biodiversity. In other words, what he found was every 62 million years, there seems to be a transition in life, and that certain species that tended to be dominant at the time suddenly disappear. At the same time, you get new species appearing.
All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and to my guest, Matthew Martirano. Matt, when we went away for break, you were talking about significant things happening in the universe that happened relative to December the 21st, 2012.
That's right, Kevin. So, you know, what we're looking at and what the question is always asked, you know, what's so special about this date? What's so special about this time? And in fact, if you look at the cosmology of the Maya, you look at the Mayan calendar, yes, the calendar ends on December 21st, 2012, but it is just the end of a cycle. And it by no means is there really substantial evidence that the creators of the calendar believed that was it, that was the end. It's kind of like the odometer turning over on your car, and you know, 999999, and then it turns over and you have 000000. So what I was looking for is there really anything special about this time? And what I was relating right before the break is that one of the things that you find is this 62 to 65 million year cycle biodiversity. Now, this has been verified at the Berkeley Labs. And what they noticed was that every 62 to 65 million years, you have a transition in the form of life on Earth. Now, about 65 million years ago, you have the extinction of the dinosaurs, but then, not too long after that, you have the origination of placental mammals. So there was actually a fossil found in 2007 in June. Where it basically dates the origins of placental mammals, so those being mammals that where their young gestate inside them, about the same time. And so, you know, scientists, they're baffled by this, they don't understand this, but really, if you look at this cycle, there is evidence that there is something going on at about a 62 million year cycle. And what happens is that the Earth passes through the galactic equator. And the cycle is 62 million years. What happens is, essentially, if you consider the Milky Way as a disk, the solar system passes to the south side about every 31 million years and then back again to the north side. So what's significant about that is that when the solar system passes to the north side, which happened very recently. It actually, we passed over the equator itself in 1998. What happens is that we lose a great deal of the protection that we enjoy from high energy rays or cosmic rays, subatomic particles, radiation just coming from the universe as a whole, and from the galaxy. And so normally we have a magnetic field that protects us from these cosmic rays. Since 1998, as we've crossed over this border, we've been steadily losing that protection.
That is true. The magnetic field around the Earth has been losing strength rapidly since about 1998. That is true.
Yes. And so this is basically caused by the shock wave, that occurs as we pass through this. The cosmic rays get generated and they come in through the north side of the disk. Mind you, when we pass over to the south side, because of the electromagnetic properties of the galaxy, we are still protected. When we pass over to the north side, that's when we lose our protection. That happens about every 62 million years. So now what does this have to do with the Mayan calendar is that a lot of people are familiar with the Mayan calendar in terms of what we call the long count of the Mayan calendar, which the last count began about 3113 BC, which does correspond pretty closely with historical records of the rise of what we would consider modern civilization in Sumeria. That ends on the 21st of December 2012. But the calendar itself actually describes cycles of time that are much, much longer than that. In fact, the longest cycle of time described by the calendar is called the Al-Autun, which does correspond, it has a periodicity of about 63 million years. So we're looking at the same time frame there in terms of Mayan calendar and in terms of where we are now with that cycle. So that's one thing that's going on. There's also another thing that's going on, and this information came out just within the last couple of years, and what scientists have discovered is that the Milky Way galaxy is, for lack of a better term, it eats neighboring satellite galaxies, and particularly one that's called the Sagittarius, the dwarf galaxy. What scientists found is that there's a stream of matter that is being sucked into the Milky Way galaxy from the Sagittarius dwarf satellite. And, of course, it makes an arc around the Milky Way, and that energy passes through the Milky Way at particular points. Now, it just so happens that our solar system is passing through that very same region of space right now where that information and energy is coming in from the Sagittarius dwarf galaxy. So we have two streams of energy coming in from there. Now, again, the crossing over of the galactic plane that happened in 1998, we're now moving into that. We're also in this background region of space where we're getting a lot of energy. Now, mind you, we're normally we would be shielded from this stuff, but right now we're not. This energy is coming in. Now, of course, the third thing that comes into play is the activity of the sun itself, which is expected to hit a solar maximum in the time frame between the end of 2011 and 2012. So you have these three sources of energy that are converging right now, concomitant with the loss of protection from those that radiation and that energy.
Well, it would seem to me that that by itself, the combination of those three sources of energy by itself would be catastrophic.
Well, it could be. And so, you know, when you look at this, all of this energy coming in, it does certainly offer an explanation for changes in climate on the planet. Of course, there's been a lot of work put out there, particularly by David Wilcock, demonstrating that the Earth is not the only planet in the solar system that is experiencing these changes, that there are many planets in the solar system that are undergoing climate change right now. And so even though emitting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere is probably not that great of an idea, it does not explain why there is climate change on Venus or Mars or Jupiter or Uranus, for example.
Or Pluto. It's happening there as well.
It is happening on Pluto as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it does explain these sort of things that you see, which does tie into those predictions that you see of cataclysm, earthquakes, volcanoes, changes in the oceans, all of this sort of thing that people have tied to, you know, what they would consider to be the end times. But what is also going on, at least I believe, is that there's also a shift in consciousness. And so realizing that life is a marriage of form and consciousness, and they're both evolving. And the idea is that there is periodically a discontinuous shift in the form that consciousness takes, so how life appears on Earth, but that the consciousness itself is continuous, that it actually can jump these singularities in time and space and continue on afterwards, and actually embody a new form, which is much more adaptable, which has a much greater degree of fitness, if you're looking at it from a biological perspective.
All right. We have a break coming up here in about 20 seconds or less. And when we come back, I want to talk about this jump that in form and what that might portend for us as one of the forms that happens to be occupying this planet at the moment. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. I'm glad you finally made it. And boy, have you missed a universe of information. We're talking with Matt Martirano, and Matt is a doctor of naturopathic medicine. He is also a researcher and sort of an accidental explorer that led to the research, and he's talking with us about some really, really interesting stuff that he discovered in the ancient sites in Peru as they relate to their alignment with certain stars, certain constellations, and what that means for us today. Now, we were talking about the three streams of, I would say, extreme energy that hit us as we pass through this galactic medium. You were talking, Matt, about the fact that every 62 million years or so, it seems there is a change in what life form is dominant and what life form then becomes dominant and replaces that. You said that consciousness can make the jump, and it doesn't have to inhabit a particular life form. All right, what does all this portend for us as a life form that happens to be the dominant life form on the planet right now?
Well, you know, I think in the end that question yet remains to be answered, but one of the keys that I think is important to understand is based on work that came out of the Russian Academy of Sciences, and one of the lead researchers by the name of Peter Garias. What he was is he was one of the researchers that originally found this discovery that has been come to known as the DNA wave effect. And basically what they had originally discovered was they took DNA samples and they irradiated them with laser light, and then there was a projection on a screen. And they projected it on a screen and there was a wave pattern that was formed, which was really not that particularly surprising. So the DNA itself is, of course, in a double helix, does take a wave pattern to itself. And so they weren't too surprised from that. What they were surprised to find was that when they took the DNA sample away, the wave pattern remained. So even though the DNA itself was gone, the wave pattern persisted. And they repeated the experiment. They did a number of control experiments to verify that this was in fact happening, and then they did confirm the results. And so this is called the phantom DNA effect. And why I think this is pertinent is because it is one of the pieces of the puzzle that demonstrates that DNA has quantum physical properties, in that it can be viewed as a particle. So you have your strands of DNA and you have your base pairs that are twisting themselves around, and then they encode for the various enzymes and proteins that allow your body to function, but that it also can flip and become a wave. And so what you see is this sort of flip over. I was watching a presentation by David Wilcock a couple weeks ago that I think explained this way better than I could, but he was talking about buckyballs and how they similarly flip over from space-time into time-space. And why that's important is that if DNA acts as a wave, then it can be informed by a wave. So if there is information coming in that is in the same frequency and phase as DNA, then that information can create changes in the DNA, which could explain the sudden transformation of life from one form to another.
Now, they've discovered that DNA, only about 10% of it has anything to do with manifesting proteins and enzymes and all of the stuff that makes us. About 90% of it, they called it junk DNA. The Russians focused on that 90%, where Western scientists focused on the 10%. Western science focuses on the 10%, and they splice a gene out or in to make changes in the matter that is manifested by that DNA. But the Russians focused on the 90% and discovered that it had patterns in it, and the patterns actually matched, appeared to match, the type of patterns that you find in human language. They called linguists in to examine it, and the linguist said, it is a language. It is grammar. It is precisely the same as human speech. And they did some experiments where they modulated the laser with human speech, and actually with human speech changed the DNA. Here's what I wonder. I've heard this from people who are into the into metaphysics, people who are into other types of spirituality, and I've heard it even from some evangelical Christians, and that is, words actually are power, and what you say actually changes things. Now, in your research, since you brought this up about DNA, did you run across this information, and what can you tell us about it?
I did, Kevin. I did run across this information, and I think you're right on. Basically, what DNA appears to represent is a universal language. And just as you said, only 10% of the DNA encodes for anything that we know of. 90% is a mystery. Somewhat coincidentally, I guess if you want to call it, the 10% of all the matter that we know of is called light matter that can be accounted for, and 90% of the matter, what we call dark matter, we don't know what that does either. And so, you know, when normally you're going through, you know, I went through my biology classes and in medical school, and they'd say, oh, you have this junk DNA, it doesn't do anything. And that always didn't sit right with me. I mean, if you look at evolution, if you look at the forces of nature, the nature is very thrifty. It takes a tremendous amount of energy to replicate DNA, and it doesn't make any sense that biological organisms would invest so much energy in replicating DNA that has no function. And so when you get into this idea that there is actually a language and that it actually responds to your words, really what you're starting to bump up against is the foundations of just about every religious cosmology that you could find that says in the beginning there was the word, that what you say has an effect on your DNA and has an effect on the way that your DNA is expressed in the world. And certainly you find this to be true in things such as neurolinguistic programming, various forms of affirmations, various forms of hypnosis, where what people say eventually becomes their experience. Now, sometimes I think that's taken to extreme, and people can, we forget that we're also in it. We coexist in the world. And so you may not be able to talk yourself out of world events, but you can certainly talk yourself into or out of your experience of them. And so one of the things that I intend to experiment with, that I would encourage people to, if you have any kind of meditation or tape that you listen to actually take that and copy it down and re-record it in your own voice. And what I suspect is that when you listen to your own voice giving yourself these suggestions, that you will get a much more powerful effect than if you just listen to another person's voice.
You know, this brings to mind a movie that I saw it a long time ago. Can't remember the name of it. Ed Asner was the lead actor, and he played the part. It's supposed to be based on a true story, and this guy was the editor, I think, at the New York Times,
it might not have been the New York Times. It's been so long since I've seen this, and I'm an old guy. I don't remember stuff. So he was diagnosed with cancer, and they told him he didn't have long to live. He, to the best of my memory about this, he was a religious man. He was Jewish. He remembered a scripture that said that laughter is health to the bones. And so he's in the hospital, and he had his friends and family bring him videotapes of every comic, every comedy show, everything he could find that was supposed to make you laugh. And he started just spending his days watching these things and just laughing, and laughed his way out of the cancer. I don't know if you're familiar with the story, but it's, as I said, it's based on a true story. And the guy, you know, his cancer went away, and he went back to work. And but that seems to me to be what we're talking about here.
Yeah, Kevin, I think so. And I have heard that story, and I think that it brings an important message in that DNA is a medium of information, and according to my understanding of it, and this is getting a little bit outside what science teaches us, actually far outside what science teaches us, but, you know, we go through life, and we have experiences, and some of them we like, and some of them we don't like, but what happens oftentimes is we go through life, we have experiences that we don't like and that we place judgments on. We just simply don't want to accept that X, Y, or Z happened to us. And certainly, you know, it's a really tough egg to swallow when you come across someone who might be more metaphysically oriented and they say, oh, well, you know, don't you know that you create your own reality and you drew this, you know, upon yourself? Well, you know, I was 3 years old when whatever happened. I mean, people say, what do you mean? And so regardless of what happened in the past, you always have the opportunity to reinterpret it. You have the opportunity to let go of your experience and pass it on. And what I believe is that DNA represents that point where the two worlds cross. And if people would allow the information to pass, to simply take the judgment off and pass it along, and let whatever is on the other side, call it your soul, call it your etheric double, whatever have you, process that information for you. It will return it to you in the form of wisdom. And what wisdom allows you to do is go out in the world and have a better experience in the future. And when I see a lot of these cases of people who have cancers, now certainly there's exposure to chemicals and what have you, but many of the times, if you look back, they have experiences in life that were very traumatic, that were very troublesome, and that they have a hard time processing. But that when people reframe the experience, so just like the example you were talking about, when someone can look at whatever happened and just laugh and say, hey, this is what happened, and here I am. You know, I'm glad I'm still here, and pass it along. That allows a change to occur. It allows that energy to pass on and not become blocked. And I believe that there is a component of that where when that energy becomes stuck in your DNA, that's what sets people up for mistranslations. And, of course, most cancers are associated with DNA transcription becoming degraded over time.
Well, it would be it's something like a physical example would be, you know, you eat a steak and it's great, you enjoy the steak, but that has to be digested and eliminated or it'll kill you. If it stays inside you, it becomes poisonous to you. And you have to digest it, and you have to eliminate it. By doing that, you get the good things out of it, and it doesn't turn to poison on you. But if it stays in your system, it will become poisonous, and it'll become harmful to your physical health. All right, now let's go back to the ancients for a moment and to the stars. We see what you have discovered and things that Jerry has told us about and others. We see that these ancient people certainly were aware of something momentous, and it was not as if they had actually seen it and experienced it. At the time that these folks in South America built four temples that were laid out in the pattern of the Southern Cross, on which today there are churches standing, because the Spaniards came in and built churches on top of those temples that they considered to be pagan temples. But we see the pattern of the Southern Cross, and then we hear you talk about how the sun will be rising, or actually the Sirius star will be rising in alignment with this layout on December 21st, 2012. They had not seen that.
The Southern Cross is in 2012. Sirius alignment was in the past.
Yeah, but they themselves had not seen that, had they?
No.
Okay, so someone, some way, something informed them that that was going to be significant. Any ideas?
Well, certainly they must have had some knowledge, and so, you know, the idea goes back to when you look at the records, you know, we call them myths, but to these people, that was their history. And a common theme that you find over and over again, whether it's from South America or North America or Africa with the Dogon tribe, Asia, Europe, all over the world, is that at some time in the past, there were other beings who came and communicated this information to them.
When you say other beings, are you saying extraterrestrials?
Well, in the sense that they did not originate from Earth, yes. But in the sense that they are very different from us, not as much.
All right, now, this god, Viracocha, was said to be very, very tall, white-skinned, bearded. I think there is some information that he had an elongated skull. And did they say anything about where Viracocha came from?
Well, according to the legend, he appeared in Lake Titicaca. There's a couple stories of where Viracocha originated from. Of course, there's like with many things, there's more than one legend, but it all seems to center around Lake Titicaca. And he, according to legend, he appeared there. Now there's the doorway of Marumuru that Jerry has investigated that seems to function somewhat as a stargate that could potentially allow a person to travel through space and time. But there's the Andean legends, and what they say is that a god of heaven came to Earth, and he exited from Lake Titicaca via a subterranean path. And he was the son of the sun, and he had a golden wand, which he found in Cusco. There's another version that says that the ancestors of the Inca came over the sea. And whichever story you choose, the point of it is that when you look at history, when you look at cultures all over the earth, you find that there's a point in their history where they say that someone came and basically handed them agriculture, writing, medicine, modern architecture, that basically all the elements that we consider to be modern civilization appeared and were given to the people by someone who already knew.
Okay, so in general terms, these days we call this the ancient astronaut theory, and it is that from somewhere out there, beings came here and basically enlightened and lifted up what we call the human race. Of course, the Sumerian story says they actually created what we call the human race, and I guess some of the stories in South America may say the same thing. Do the Mayan, Incas, the Aztec, do any of those cultures talk about an impending return of these beings?
Well, yeah, they all do. Certainly, in the Inca tradition, there was the return of Quetzalcoatl, who is basically another incarnation of Viracocha, and of course, as history goes, when Cortez landed, the people of the time thought he was Quetzalcoatl, and so that was one of the ways that he could take advantage of the situation. But the overlaying idea is that the return, whatever you look at in the context of whatever culture or cosmology, is that the return is not so much one individual, but that the return is in all people, that the one individual represents the potential for all mankind.
All right, now is, and I'm going to say this, and then we have to take this break. We'll answer it when we come back. Is that 21st century thinking being read back into the ancient myths? We'll examine that when we come back. We'll be back, folks, after this, and we'll take your telephone calls. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking with Matt Martirano. The telephone lines are open at 623-444-5889. If you need to call me toll-free, you can do so at 888-223-4599. As always, if you're outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, you can call 623-444-5889. It will work from anywhere in the world. But if you don't want to make the international long-distance call, you can send me a flash message if you're outside of the USA and outside of Canada. Now, you do that by going to my website, scroll down, and you'll see the link that says flash message. My website is kevinsmithshow.com. All right, Matt, before we went to break, you were talking about the return of these gods, and that, in fact, it's not just the return of a god, but it's the potential in all of us. And I asked the question, is that 21st century thinking overlaid over what they actually wrote, what they actually said? So let me give you a shot at answering that question.
Sure. Well, you know, you can look at it both ways. But if you go back to the Bible, which is, you know, the one of the sacred texts that is most revered on the planet, and certainly there are others. But if you look at the teachings of Jesus, he very clearly states, he says that all that he has done, we shall do, and more. And so when people go back and they want to look to one person, be it a historical or mythological feature, and say, figure, and say, okay, well, look at all these superhuman powers or these miracles, that person said that we all have the potential within us to do the same. And when you look at the Maya, for example, they talked about these ages in terms of suns, and they said that if you go through history, there's the creation and destruction of worlds, and that we're currently in the fifth sun. The sixth sun, which is the world that we're moving into, according to the Maya, nothing is written. It's completely blank. There is no predetermination of events. It's entirely up to us to create it to be whatever we want it to be. And so, in that, I think that there's how it comes down to this whole 2012 experience is that we're passing through a doorway, we're passing through a gateway, and everyone's going to go through, whether or not they're aware of it, whether or not they like it. But they're going to come through the other side. Now, there's more than one way. There's more than one choice that can be made to go through the doorway. And if your belief is that there's going to be one super being that leads you through, then that's the experience you're going to have. If you believe that we're going to go through some sort of worldwide catastrophe, then that's what you're going to experience. If you believe that it's going to be a renaissance of all humanity, then that's what it could be. And in fact, all of these scenarios are happening right now. And if you look for any one of them, you can find it. And so ultimately, it's really up to each individual to decide how they want to pass through, but you're going to pass through one way or another. That's what I think the core of the teachings tell us.
Okay. I want to go back to this formation of four churches built on the sites of four ancient temples. And you said something about the number 13, 31, 13. Tell us again what that was.
Oh, excuse me, 13, 31, 13. That is the latitude of Coricancha, the Temple of the Sun. So it's located at 13 degrees south, 31 minutes and 13 seconds.
Okay, at Coricancha.
Yes.
All right. Now, there's a reason I ask about that. Here's the reason. I have heard from a number of different people who have been here on the show about us having 12 strands of DNA with only two that are active. And that as we pass through this galactic medium, all 12 sort of light up, come to light, and who knows what they will do. Have you heard this?
Yeah, actually, Kevin, I have heard that, and believe it or not, that's one of the ideas that originally actually turned me off to this concept, because at the time, according to my understanding, having a background in biology, I thought to myself, no, DNA has two strands, and that's what it has, and there's no way for DNA to organize itself into a higher order. Now, since that time, I've learned that I'm wrong, and that, in fact, there is evidence that DNA can form a triple structure and also a quadruplex DNA. Now, those things have been documented. They're in the scientific literature. In terms of 12 strands, I haven't seen anything that I would say can verify that scientifically, but based on my being wrong in the past, I wouldn't want to categorically say that that's impossible either.
All right, if you take the number...
to do,
if you take the number of the latitude, 13, 31, 13, add all the digits together, you get 12. If you add the 1 and the 2 together, you get 3. And you've just told us that there is scientific literature stating that DNA can organize itself into a triple strand.
That's correct.
I wonder if there's any significance that on 2012, this the Southern Cross lines up with this site in Peru at 13, 31, 13, which reduces to 3. I wonder if there's any significance between that and the idea that more of our DNA gets switched on.
Well, I think so. And if you look at our DNA right now in its binary form, we have two streams of information that are coinciding. Now, what was found in Australia, this was published in the Astrophysical Journal Letters, it was that, in fact, this finger of energy that's leaving the dwarf Sagittarius cloud is arriving at Earth near a point of the Southern Cross. And so, in my mind, that definitely suggests, of course, along with the fact that we were going to no longer have this natural electromagnetic barrier, that there's another stream of information coming in, so that instead of simply being informed by the sun and the center of the galaxy, we're going to have another stream of information that's available to us that would physicalize itself or cause DNA to reorganize itself more towards the triple-stranded DNA structure. And certainly we have seen, if you look at the fields put out by the galactic center itself, there was a couple years ago discovered that there was a formation of a star cluster, I believe. I'm looking for the details on that right now, but of a double helix.
Yeah, there is it's a nebula. And they refer to it as the DNA nebula because it looks like DNA. It's just a long string of double helix. Now, the Russians, in their experiments with DNA, the Russians discovered that they could manipulate DNA with RF, basically radio frequency, at the right frequency. They could manipulate and change DNA with radio. And in one of their experiments, they encoded the radio frequency with the DNA sequences of a salamander. And then they irradiated DNA from a toad with the salamander message, and it changed to salamander DNA.
Yep, that's exactly correct. That experiment was done, and it essentially they reprogrammed the DNA of the salamander, and they created a new life form.
Now, here's where I'm headed with this. When you look at the ancient Sumerian symbol for man, that ancient symbol is a pole around which are entwined two serpents. Looks like DNA. On the left and on the right, there is a griffin with a very long sword, and it's as if these griffins are pressing against the serpents, keeping them together, not letting them get out of that formation. It has been suggested that those griffins with the swords represent some type of force that keeps our DNA confined to two. If you introduce this other force, this other energy stream that you're talking about, it would nullify that there being these two forces keeping us constrained. Now there's three. And that makes a lot of sense to me, that it could then change our DNA. But with the Sumerians using that as the depiction for man, you gotta wonder how much of this did they understand? Because they have put in a picture form essentially the scientific information. And that being that there's two strands of DNA and something constrains it to stay two.
Well, that's correct. And so there's a lot of historical evidence that someone understood this information and encoded it in symbology so that it could be passed along, realizing ahead of time that over the course of the millennia...
Matt, I hate to do it, but the music's taking over. We've got to step away for a break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are on Final Approach. That means we only have a few minutes left in tonight's show, and we're talking with Matt Martirano. Matt, I had to cut you off because the break was taking over, but you were responding to what I had said about, you know, it seems that when you look at the symbology from the Sumerians, way back then, we're talking thousands of years ago, what you see in the pictures seems to match what science tells us about DNA. I mean, there are two strands. Something constrains it to two. And that's what they have pictured there. And then, of course, you're talking about the introduction of this other stream of energy coming in now. And that would, of course, obliterate there being two.
That's right, and essentially, I think that you're right on, in that what is depicted by the symbology there is that there are two streams, and they're held in by these electromagnetic forces that we've been experiencing over the last age that prevent this other information from coming in. So if you look at a typical sort of electromagnetic spectrum that you pull out of a high school textbook or something, it'll tell you that most electromagnetic energy at the ultraviolet range and above cannot penetrate the Earth's atmosphere. But since we've crossed over that galactic plane, all bets are off. That, though, as the magnetic barrier holding those two together falls, it's open game for these new energies to come in. And so DNA having a quantum wave effect can certainly spontaneously reorganize itself into a structure of higher order. And I think that's what we're seeing here.
Do you have any predictions about what sort of changes this may bring? I mean, is it going... We start talking about, you know, a possible third strand of DNA becoming active here. Okay. Is that going to happen in those of us who are alive right now, or is that going to happen in our offspring?
That's a question that I still debate from day to day. I can certainly see that a person right now who's living with two strands of DNA can give birth to the next evolutionary step. The things that we've talked about tonight seem to support that that's possible in terms of the salamander experiment and so on. If it can happen within a person who's still alive, I don't know. I tend to think yes, but I really don't have anything solid that I could fall back on and say this is why I think yes. But I think that people who are here now, when you look at the technologies that we have, within the last, you know, little over a century, what you have is hearing at a distance, telephone, sight at a distance, the television, we have the internet, we have all these technologies, and what I think, and this does go along with the Jose Arguelles theory, is that these technologies are an external expression of abilities that are latent inside ourselves. And either we're going to be able to experience this change inside our bodies, or there's going to be some mechanism that becomes available to transfer consciousness from this body to another body that's, say, more equipped without a break in between. That's what I think. But that's speculation.
All right. Now, I have a flash message here from Tom in Australia. And he says, the galactic medium is just an optical illusion that will only be experienced by a person standing on our planet. Our solar system as a whole passed through the galactic medium many thousands of years ago and will not be actually passing through the galactic medium for many more thousands of years. It's a myth that our solar system is about to pass through the galactic medium on or about 2012. This fact is supported by solid scientific evidence and is not the product of hysterical doomsayers who base their claims on myths. 2012 is also just a hysterical myth, as time will no doubt prove. I want to give you an opportunity to respond to that, and we have about 3 minutes here.
All right. Well, I'll say that I partially agree and I partially disagree with that. I entirely agree that much of what you hear about the 2012 scenario and the doomsday and the doom and gloomers is completely fabricated. I think it's being capitalized upon by people who basically play upon our fear. And I believe that the message of 2012, if anything else, is for us to go beyond our fear. Now, in terms of when we cross this galactic plane, according to my understanding, we did cross it in 1998. So it wasn't thousands of years ago, but we crossed it in 1998, and it's going to be 65-some million years before we cross it again. In terms of it being an optical illusion, well, yes, it is an optical illusion, but it's still significant because it depends on how you look at the universe. If you think that the universe and the galaxy and the stars and the planets are just these floating balls of rocks and gases that are randomly floating around, well, yeah, then it's totally meaningless. But if you look at it in terms of energetic streams that are coming from sources and being absorbed by others, then yes, it does matter that when, from one particular perspective, these streams line up, then you essentially are connected in at that moment. Now, from someone else in a different perspective and another place and time, no, it's completely meaningless. But for the people who are here in this place and time, it is. It's just like when you look at the ideas there a couple years ago of traveling to Mars. Well, are you going to travel to Mars when it's far away from Earth and at a strange angle, or are you going to do it when it's lined up and when you can take a straight line? And if you consider the idea that all of these bodies in the galaxy are actually emitting energy, which they are, we know that, then there's pathways, there's lines, there's magnetic field lines, there's electromagnetic streams, and those have pathways that can be mapped. We certainly know that there are streams of cosmic rays coming out from the galaxy center, there's, and from other sources, there's streams of energy coming out from the sun. And just like if the sun has a sunspot or a CME and we happen to be in the path of that CME, well, it blows out our communication systems. If we happen to be geometrically aligned where we're not in the pathway, it doesn't do anything. And so it is of significance.
Well, you know, the sky,
symmetrically in terms to other things,
the sky itself is an optical illusion. You walk outside in the daytime and you look up at the sun. Well, you're not seeing the sun. You're seeing the sun 8 minutes ago. It takes 8 minutes for its light to get from there to here. So when you look up at the sun, you're seeing where it actually was 8 minutes ago. All right, folks, that's a wrap. And Matt, if you will stay on the line with me a moment. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.